welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is Charlie Slaman. Charlie is a technical leader at Cisco Systems working on reliability physics, risk assessment of advanced semiconductor technology and future DRAM. He's also the general chair of the International Reliability Physics Symposium, which is what we're going to talk about today. Welcome to the podcast, Charlie.
Thank you for inviting me, Dan. This is I'm really excited to be able to talk to you about IRPS and what's new and what we are looking forward to in the future.
Okay, but first, Charlie, can you tell me what first brought you to semiconductors?
So when I started, in high school, I was interested in the technical sciences, natural sciences, as well as the hard sciences. So I went to school at Berkeley in the physics department because that was a topic I was very interested in, and got my bachelor's degree from Berkeley in physics. I wanted to get a master's degree, but more along the lines of applied physics, not so much theoretical. There was really no applied physics department at Berkeley, but there was the electrical engineering and computer science department, which was actually very active in the semiconductor technology area at the time, and in fact had a fab up on the fourth floor of Corey Hall. So I applied to the graduate program in electrical engineering, was accepted. Turned out not to get my master's degree. I went straight through for the PhD. Interestingly enough, there was not a requirement at the time to get a master's first and then a PhD. And the part I was working on was a metal barrier metal junction, which was intended to be a very high frequency semiconductor or tunneling device. Got my PhD thesis on that, doing millimeter wave mixing and detection. And from there, I went into industry.
Where have you been? I mean, you're at Cisco now. Where were you before that?
So I started out at Hughes Research Labs at the time because my work in the millimeter wave area with the metal barrier metal junctions was something that Hughes Aircraft was interested in because of the radar and laser systems they were building. So I started at the research labs working on gallium arsenide optical and microwave devices, and then saw the trend towards the silicon VLSI technology, moved from the gallium arsenide area into the silicon area, and then from there joined Cypress Semiconductor and also Alliant Semiconductor, which was one of the first fabless companies. And so at Alliant, I got introduced into the foundry business and then moved over to Sun Microsystems because I wanted to learn a little bit more about how do these semiconductor devices actually get used in systems. And so spent a long time at Sun Microsystems, started working in the area of the soft errors, the neutron-induced soft errors, because Sun was having a real problem with that. And then from Sun, I moved on to Brocade and finally ended up here at Cisco.
Yeah, that's an impressive resume. You know, I worked with Sun, too, back in the day. So you were on the Spark systems, I assume?
Yes, and actually I was on the, first started out on the Spark systems and then moved into the DRAM area because at the time Sun was bringing on board new DRAM suppliers and they needed someone who understood semiconductor technology who could evaluate what's the reliability of these new DRAM manufacturers going to be, what do we need to look at. And once I was in this DRAM memory area, then this soft air issue popped up with the cosmic rays, the terrestrial neutrons. Turned out not to be in the DRAMs, it turned out to be in the SRAMs. But at that point, that was kind of my learning on soft airs. And then worked on the first JEDEC standard. This is back more than 20 years ago. Interestingly enough, May and Wood discovered alpha particle errors in DRAMs and actually published for the first time at the 1978 IRPS. But the neutrons were a new kind of a new phenomenon that came came along 20 years later, and there was no JEDEC standard on how to measure soft airs, even though soft airs had been around since May and Wood. There was no JEDEC standard on how to measure and characterize. So we went to work and created a JEDEC standard, which is now in its third revision, JESD 89C.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, you know, those two are my favorite companies, Cypress and Sun Microsystems. But, you know, let's get back to IRPS. So what is IRPS, Charlie?
So IRPS is the IEEE International Reliability Physics Symposium. And it is focused on reliability physics of microelectronic devices. So it's not a design conference. It's not a product conference. It's really a kind of a physics conference. When you think about it, the topics that get discussed are the physics of the semiconductor microelectronic devices and how they change, how they break, or, you know, how to design them so they don't break, so that they are reliable. So both aspects of how they break and how to make them reliable.
Yeah, that's a 60-plus-year-old conference, right?
Yes. In fact, this was the 60th anniversary this year. So we are almost as old as IEDM. IEDM is kind of our sister conference. So IEDM focuses on the products, on the microelectronic devices and new microelectronic devices. And IRPS focuses on, once everybody decides it's production worthy, it's a good device to put into production, IRPS kind of goes to work on, okay, how's it going to break? How do you make it reliable? And there's a lot of overlap between the two. IEDM is, I think, about 10 years older than IRPS.
Yeah, IEDM, that's one of the conferences I go to. That's an excellent conference. It's here in San Francisco. But I see that that IRPS was in Monterey. That's quite a location.
Yes, yeah, it's a lovely location. We're going to be there again this coming year in 2023. We're at the Monterey Hyatt, which is a beautiful venue. It sits up on the hill overlooking the Monterey Bay. It's an easy walk down, you know, maybe a 20-30 minute walk down to Fisherman's Wharf. So it's really it's an idyllic location, and it's just the right size for us. The conference center there can hold about up to 500, I believe, and that's kind of the target we shoot for to be able to grow the conference.
Yeah, I'm a sailor. I have a sailboat. I sail down there. So I'll probably sail down there for the conference next year.
Yeah, I love the location. It's, you know, we live in San Jose. We're about midway between San Francisco and Monterey. So when Claudia and I have a chance, you know, we want to go out, spend a nice weekend, we always turn south to Monterey because it's much less crowded than San Francisco. And it's you've got the Big Sur area and Pebble Beach and Carmel. And it's a lovely location.
Yeah. So what else is unique about IRPS other than the location?
So what makes IRPS unique is that we have gone to this hybrid format. We're one of the first conferences to do that. And what I mean by hybrid format is it's a full hybrid interaction between the speakers and the attendees who are on site, as well as the speakers and attendees who are virtual. We have set the conference up this year, and we plan to continue that for next year, to be able to allow interaction between both the on-site attendees and speakers and the remote attendees and speakers. As I mentioned, we had about 195 in-person attendees and about 232 virtual. So that really speaks strongly to the desire people to get back face-to-face, but there are still those who are challenged to travel. So if we had just a face-to-face conference, our attendance numbers would be down. So we decided to do this hybrid format, and it really worked out.
Yeah, other conferences are doing the same. I agree completely. You know, we've been virtual for a while, and I enjoy virtual conferences because, you know, we can, you know, sit at home, but it's not as good as live. But it's good to have the option to do both because travel is restricted, you know, for some people, and it probably will continue to be. So I think that's a great model. So one other thing I want to ask you about, you know, reliability physics isn't wasn't a huge term in our industry, but now it is. Everybody's talking about reliability, and it's partly because automotive is more semiconductors, and semiconductors are getting into a lot more products that last longer than, you know, a smartphone, right? So what's your view on that?
Exactly. So it's actually kind of a perfect storm in the sense that we now are seeing these microelectronic devices used in applications that need much longer reliability. So in the case of a cell phone, the cell phone probably becomes obsolete before the semiconductor in it dies. Sure. But whereas in a car, the car is going to be around for several years. So all those semiconductor components better last. That's one aspect. The other aspect that's happening is as we continue scaling into the deep nanometer range, the reliability physics of things like hot carrier injection, time-dependent dielectric breakdown, negative bias temperature instability, these are becoming more severe. And what's happening then is that you can design a circuit that works at time zero, but as the transistor ages and you run, and these mechanisms that I just mentioned start to shift the threshold voltage, the circuit will no longer work. So you have to put enough margin, threshold voltage margins into the design in order that these shifts or aging that takes place still allow the circuit to work over the intended lifetime. But the problem is putting that margin in is taking away from, say, your performance numbers. And in order to continue to improve performance by scaling, you also have to manage what your reliability margins are. So you no longer have the luxury of putting in these big guard band margins, because that then takes away from performance and you're fighting to get more and more performance as things scale. So it's becoming more and more difficult to scale technologies and get the performance without having reliability then break that rule. So now it becomes, you have what's called design for reliability. So you have to take into account how are your devices going to age, and then put in enough margin in the design so that it lasts the intended lifetime, or put in some adaptive circuits. And that's another hot topic of having circuits that kind of compensate for their aging. And as the joke goes, you know, what's the perfect race car? It's the one that breaks down just after it crosses the start-finish line. So that's kind of what we're dealing with here. We don't want to over-design for reliability, because we won't have the fastest race car. On the other hand, we don't want to over-design for performance, because the race car is going to break before it hits the start-finish line. So that's that's why reliability is becoming a much more important topic as we scale, is it's now has to be an integral part of the design thinking. And also now the designers have to comprehend where these parts are going to get used. What is their use environment? So automotive is pointed out as a very, very stringent use environment and a very long life. But if you look at the automotive applications, you're not running your car all the time, whereas you're probably running your server 24/7. So there are trade-offs in these reliability designs that are very much a function of how and where is this part going to get used, and what is its expected lifetime?
Yeah, you know, I think cars really have automotive is what brought this term, you know, in the press more frequently. And I see it on SemiWiki, design for reliability and aging, even more importantly. These are trending terms on SemiWiki. And it's the cars that are the issue, I think, because cars are everywhere and everybody's concerned. And, you know, look at the weather condition cars go through, right? It's not your normal server or your cell phone or anything. And, you know, if something goes wrong in your car, and your car has hundreds of chips now, you know, that's personally concerning, right?
Absolutely. And that's a great point of how the as I mentioned, the reliability requirements really depend upon the use. So in the case of a server, if a processor or if a board goes out, there's a whole there's a thousand other boards in that server farm or in that data center, right? So you just quickly route traffic to a different server. So even though reliability of servers is very important because you've got so many of them, if one breaks, you just use the redundancy to route information and computing to another board. In a car, if the car breaks, that's your car. You don't, unless you have another one in the garage and it broke down at home, you don't have any redundancy. So in a sense, there the only redundancy you can build into a car is the redundancy of the systems themselves. Are there backups? The automotive folks really kind of have to think about all of that stuff. Is okay, if this breaks, you know, then what? How do we keep the car limping along? How do we keep it so that the customer can get into the dealer or into a repair shop? So it's a much more stringent requirement.
No, it's mission critical. So the question is, how many automotive people were at the conference this year? I mean, I'm concerned. Let's get these people.
So we have, yes, and we have automotive. We've had tutorials on automotive reliability, and we are gaining momentum. We're getting more of the automotive companies in right now. What we're seeing is the companies who are serving or building the semiconductors for the automotive company. So we'll see people say from a Global Foundries. Who is building chips that go into cars. We don't necessarily see folks from Ford or General Motors in the past, but that's now starting to change. And so we're starting to see more involvement from the automotive community, and I expect that to continue. So kind of in the beginning, since we were a physics symposium, the Ford and the GM engineers are like, nah, this is not, we don't get this stuff, so we'll just rely on our suppliers. But they are starting to get more involved now.
Yeah, I can tell you that for a fact. Is you know, I just started seeing domains from automotive companies, you know, over the last few years, and Tesla was actually the first one, and that's how I knew Tesla was creating their own semiconductors. But now all the automotive domains are all over SemiWiki. We have a huge automotive readership. So I'm expecting they are going to be coming to your symposium in droves because they are doing their own chips now, right? At least a lot of them are.
Yes, right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's funny you should mention Tesla because Brian Tracy, who is a reliability engineer at Tesla, has been on the IRPS technical program committee in the area of failure analysis for several years now.
Well, that's good to hear because Tesla has the most semiconductors in them of all the cars that I know of.
Yes. And Tesla is kind of the model of they're as much a microelectronics or semiconductor company as they are an automotive company because of their roots, the way they got started. So Tesla got started, it was already heavy into the electronics technology, whereas the Fords and the GMs, you know, kind of got their roots in the mechanical, and over time, the electronics has started to become, you know, a more important part of the automobile.
Yeah. When I saw Tesla on SemiWiki, this was years ago, I looked them up on LinkedIn, and I saw, you know, a dozen of my people I know on LinkedIn worked at Tesla, you know, semiconductor professionals. So yeah, they staffed up early. They started out right.
Yeah, the article I read in the BMW Owners Club magazine, one of the club members took an electrical vehicle around the U.S. He wanted to do the four corners. Now, BMW has electric cars, but he didn't take a BMW. He took a Porsche Taycan and kind of went through all the stuff. He had to do all the apps and the phones to find charging stations. And what he pointed out was that, you know, the Taycan was a great electric car, but the work he had to do figuring out how he had to travel and get to charging stations, he said Tesla already had that built into their cars. So if he did this trip in a Tesla – it would be a no-brainer. Doing it in any other car than a Tesla, he just had to work hard at figuring out the infrastructure. Now, down the road, we're going to have, you know, a decade from now, that's not going to be a problem. But Tesla figured that out in the very beginning. They figured it out when they first started designing their cars, that, hey, we're not just selling an electric car. We've got to build the infrastructure for it so people can use these cars. And it was very similar. It occurred to me, it's something that Scott McNeely said when Sun was working on all this free Java software and things like that, and Solaris, and people would say, well, you're not making money off of that. And he said, you know, we're building locomotives, but if you don't have train tracks, you can't sell locomotives. So we've got to build the train tracks as we build our locomotives. IBM's were building locomotives, but they weren't building the train tracks. It was Sun that was building the train tracks.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Scott McNeely, great guy. I actually knew him a little bit, and just really smart guy. And I remember that quote, by the way. So, you know, in closing, let's talk about 2023. So what's new in 2023? Who should consider going to IRPS besides obviously the automotive people? So what do you have in store for us next year?
So what we have in store next year, as I mentioned, we are planning a hybrid conference because we think there are still going to be companies are going to have travel restrictions on some of their employees, or at least some companies will. So we will continue with the hybrid format to allow those who can't attend in person be able to attend virtually. We will ask that the authors must be in person, because the in-person attendees really want to interact with the authors, and the best way to do that is have the authors at the conference. So we'll have this hybrid format where we'll allow virtual attendance, but we will also have the in-person presentations. Anyone who is doing research in the field of microelectronics reliability and wants to publish their research, this is the best conference to do it. So 2023 is the place to come. For those who are learning about reliability physics, either students or, say, new hires, IRPS is a one-stop shop. You can come, you can go to the tutorials and pick up a lot of good material in a day or two. You can also listen to some great invited speakers on the various topics. We also have evening workshops, so you can actually interact with the experts in the field in these evening workshops. So it's basically, whether you're learning or whether you're doing the leading edge research, IRPS 2023 in Monterey is going to be the place to go.
Well, I agree, and I will definitely see you there. I'll be in the marina, but I will stop by the conference.
That's great. And it's, from the marina up to the Hyatt, I believe it's only a 20 or a 30 minute. It's an easy walk. And a lot of the attendees, what they'll do in the evening is, you know, after the conference is over, they'll just walk right down to Fisherman's Wharf to have dinner. So it's a lovely location also. And you've got Pebble Beach and Carmel and Big Sur if you want to come early, if you want to come the weekend before or stay the weekend after. It's a great destination.
Great. Well, I know we've seen each other at conferences. I'm sure we'll be seeing each other again before 2023 IRPS, but I will definitely be there. So thanks again for your time, Charlie. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. And have a good day.
Thanks for inviting me, Dan.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.